Hi, Dan.
Hi, Jason.
Oh, I'm much less jet lagged now. It's so much better. Oh, my God.
Oh. It's good. It takes about a week, I find.
Yeah.
I'm slow to adjust.
Yeah. But. Yeah. It's coming around. By Monday morning, I was actually pretty good shape. So that's good. Back at it. Did upgrade and wrote a bunch of articles. And I was very productive on Monday, which was pretty nice.
The opposite of my Mondays. My Mondays are always... The reentry from the weekend is always slow for me.
Well, that's having a podcast at 9 a.m. Monday really
it does
shapes you up.
Probably
let me tell
kick
you.
Things off. Yeah, I had it was a week where I, don't usually have anything scheduled on Monday. Usually Tuesday afternoon is where stuff starts. And then I realized both of my Tuesday afternoon podcast had been rescheduled to Wednesday, which I had forgotten. And my Tuesday night podcast was canceled. And I was like, oh, I don't really have any structure until Wednesday this week. So that was exciting.
Yeah, it's dangerous to put us out of structure. Structure is...
I just don't know what to do with myself.
It's good. It's good. My week is bracketed by 9 a.m. podcasts on Monday and Friday. It's very helpful.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like we've been saying, not a lot of stuff going on right now. Everything's bubbling under the surface in terms of Apple stuff.
Mm-hmm.
BB-Edit 14 came out, which people who know will care and love it. Although I actually think it's a major milestone for them because what they've implemented is language server support. Which is something that originated in Microsoft's Visual Studio Code, but it's the idea that it is a way for any code editor to basically talk to an independent. It's called a server, but it runs locally that has all of the syntax checking and definitions and all this sort of stuff, and allows that all to be live. And Microsoft basically kind of pushed it out into making it a standard so that any editor could use it. And now BBEdit can use it. And I think there's for a class of user, it's an enormous upgrade because it means that whatever language you're writing in, you now have access to that within BBEdit. And so BBEdit becomes vastly more functional. But all BBEdit had to do was implement LSP, and then you just run whatever language server you want. And it's early days. I mentioned this in my write-up. It's early days because, as you might expect, a lot of these servers kind of only expect Microsoft Visual Studio Code to talk to them. Because that's where it started. And, we've seen this with other things, too, where something starts as being a one-to-one relationship and it becomes a standard. And then there's the shakedown period where where the makers of the server, in this case, realize that they've got multiple clients. It's like, oh, it's like the web early days, really, where it's like, oh, no, there's more than one browser. Oh, no.
Right.
And they do things differently. And then everybody kind of works on it and ideally it gets somewhere. But I was using it the other day with a Python script, and it's completely messed up on my Mac. I don't know what is wrong with my Mac, but on the iMac running the beta of Monterey, actually, I put it on there and I was fiddling around with a Python script, and it's pretty amazing. Like when I would make an error, like the line number section of the editor would just light up red and be like, oh no, there's something bad here. And then I would fix it and it would go bing, and then it would be fine again. I thought, okay, I don't know what's wrong with my version that's on my Mac, but I think I have too many. I think I have two versions of Python, and it's a mess. But on a fresh install on a beta operating system, it actually worked great. So, and there's some other fun stuff in there. The script, it's official now that anyone could do it, is the script that I built. I asked them for the feature that would basically say, can you make it so when I drag an image into BBEdit, it runs a script? And to the credit of Bare Bones, they said, that's a good idea. We'll do that. And they wrote what is like an attachment point script thing. And so now I've got, and I posted it in the a little video of it in the article. I can take any image that I want to put in a 6-color story that I'm writing in BBEdit and drag it into where I want it. And what looks like it happens is basically like HTML code for that image appears in the article. But what's actually happening behind the scenes is it's resizing the image, uploading it to our server, getting back what the image URL is, then writing the HTML and inserting it in BBEdit. And it all just kind of works. So That's BB Edit life. Is you it keeps advancing and you find new little things. And they added a notes feature, which seems redundant, except there are apparently so many BB Edit people who have like untitled text 823. Yep. And so now there's this notes window that's sort of like persistent, and like the notes app, it'll auto title itself and it auto saves and it's in its own little space, which is in the file system, and they're all just text files. But like, it's a good example of, and Apple does this sometimes too, and I think all good developers do it. It's a good example of looking at how your users use your software and saying, mm-hmm. look, you shouldn't do that. And then the users are like, but I do. And then you're like, all right, how can I make this better since you insist on doing this? It's a little bit like the early days of the iPad where Apple's like, no, you don't want to take pictures with your iPad. Okay, everybody's taking pictures with their iPad. Guess we better make the cameras better, right? This is like that with BB Edit, where it's just like, don't have 900 open untitled. Okay, fine. We made a thing for you.
Yeah. It's funny. I was talking, Lex Fridman did this exact thing. He talks about he has all his like untitled notes or whatever. And I've definitely left documents untitled, not for notes, but like sometimes there is a weird mental block where it's like sometimes I start writing something and it doesn't quite go anywhere. And I'm like, well,
if you save it, it's not real. Oh, if you save it and close it, then it's fine. It's fine.
Oh, yeah. But if you save it and close it, it's also like, I will forget about it and I will never look at it again. And it's like, instead, I end up with like six windows that like all, you were talking about minimizing this week on Upgrade, I think.
Oh, yeah.
Or 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, the big minimizers.
Yeah, and I was like, I definitely minimize all this stuff in BB Edit. And so it's funny because I'll open it and you'll see like six little windows go whoop,
into the dock.
Right? Like into the dock. Yes. It's kind of dumb. And someday I'll go through and clean them all out. But at the same time, I just end up with, I have no idea what they even are anymore. That's the problem. They're just sitting there because,
Like three or four. So this is what they've done is they've made this notes thing because it's just people use it. And I think it's good, right? Like there are two ways to be a developer of software, and one of them, or of products in general. And one of them is to say, you use it this way. This is the only intended use. Anything else you do, we don't care. We're only going to support this. And the other way is to look at what your users are doing with your product and go, all right, I guess I should make that better since they're all doing it and it's not very good. And there's no right answer there, right? Like sometimes I think you look at how somebody uses, like talk about BB Edit. My approach to BB Edit is very much like, I don't want to ask for too much from BB Edit because I don't feel like I'm their user. I feel like if they tried to conform their product too much to be me, to like serve my needs, it would be bad for the product, right? Like don't listen to me, essentially. But there are other times where I think it has value. So it's sort of like, you don't want to distort your product because of where your users are taking it necessarily, but there could also be an opportunity to understand like how your product could be better, and it's an interesting balancing point. And that's when we talk about defaults and Apple that Apple chooses, and when Apple tries to do new things, it's the same thing, right? Like they're trying to think about how people are using their devices and how they can make that better, and that I think that motivates a lot of their decisions too.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think that there's like you said, it's like being, you know, in language, there's the descriptivist versus prescriptivist approaches. It's mm-hmm. kind of a similar analogy where it's like, oh, these are the rules and you almost always do what the rules say. Or, well, things kind of evolve and, you know, new stuff happens and we just kind of document the stuff that's already there. It's the same sort of idea of like, should we prescribe exactly how you use our app or should we look at how people use our app and then adapt to that? I think it is nice because software ultimately, you know, it's no point if you come up with the best software idea in the world and nobody else wants it. Like, great for you if it works, like does something you want to do, but it's not going to be very useful if nobody else wants to use it the way that you think it should be used. So,
yeah, you know, I mean, if Barebones had come out with a new version that was just like untitled documents above 100 will be deleted, right? It would be like, why are you doing
why,
this?
Why
like,
would you do
we're
that?
The police, and we decided you have too many documents. And instead, it's like, okay, you guys are using it this way. Let's try to figure something out.
Speaking of the police, we should talk about the
what did Sting do this time?
Yeah. Oh, Sting. iDOS. Potentially pulled from Apple. Speaking of the app
fun police are here. Here to tell you. Oh, by the way, the fun police, not fun. They're not fun.
They really
shut
aren't.
Down fun. Boo. Yeah.
So I wrote a little bit today. I think, you know, Gruber wrote his very brief take on it, which I think was to the point. Uh-huh. But I think there's a bigger issue here, which I was expanding on, which is, and we've talked a bunch about App Store stuff in the past and the vagaries of Apple's rules and the fact that they're dealing with antitrust stuff. And, you know, Apple sets down its rules. And as we've discussed before, they claim the we didn't make the rules, that we just enforced them, but you did make the rules. And I think that, you know, their rules take a very one-size-all approach, right? Where it's like, well, your rule, we specifically said you can't do this thing, and your app does this thing, even though the reasons it does this thing may not be the things that we're actually concerned about, right? Like,
Yeah. Oh,
you could load unlicensed content. It's freaking DOS, guys.
Yeah.
It has nothing that runs there is, you know... Yes, and you can run a pirated version of Windows 3.1. Knock yourself out.
That you could, right? Like that's the part that really bugs me, because what they're saying is, if you can use this for piracy, you can't use it, which is the opposite of, like, I was thinking when BitTorrent became big, right? And BitTorrent can be used for piracy. But BitTorrent is also used to distribute downloads of legitimate software. And it's actually kind of brilliant for that, right? Because not one source doesn't have to have all the bandwidth. You get ultra-fast downloads because everybody's sharing the bandwidth. Who's doing the downloads?
Should somebody let Apple know that you could read pirated EPUBs in books?
Well, this is...
Maybe they want to know.
Yeah, this is my point. And so they're like, oh, no, we're going to draw the line here. It was like, if you've got a licensed copy of Windows 3.1 and you...
And
it's legal for you to install it on other devices, let's just say that, right? Like,
you know what the funniest part of this...
No, we can't have that. We can't have legal use because it might not be legal use.
Right. My funniest example for that would be, you know... iTunes Match is like, literally, here, take your pirate songs, we'll give you legal copies. Like,
yes,
I know you set up a program for that, I get it, but you're still kind of saying, oh, what you did in the past, that was okay, let's not worry about that. And I don't know, with iDOS especially, like, A, it's an impressive piece of software. I mean, it's built on DOSBox, which is a fairly common, like, emulator thing, but it's clever on that, runs on the iPad. And I think the larger point that stands here is, Apple has taken this road of positioning the iPad as, like, it does everything your computer does, right? Like, they had that whole ad campaign, like, what's a computer, right? Because the whole point is the iPad, it does it all. And it's like, well, it doesn't. And not only does it not do it, it doesn't do all those things because you specifically are not allowing those things.
It can do all of those things, and Apple won't let it.
Right. And that is a kick in the shins to the users, right? Because if your argument is it's just as good as a Mac and can do all the things Mac can do, except for these things that we say it can't do, not because it can't, you know, capable of doing those things, but we just don't want it to, then you're saying, well, you can use this program as good as a computer, asterisk, you know, if you only want to do the things that we specifically let you do. I think that's a disservice to Apple's own users, and it's just... It is the place where I do feel like I don't want my computer platform to be locked down to what Apple says it can do. That feels
so
rotten,
so frustrating. And this is my point when people talk about the App Store and the lawsuits and what will happen with that and sideloading and all those things. I'm not going to be one of those people. I'm never going to be one of those people on the internet who has the like black and white argument. Like, it is super nuanced and it's hard. But you cannot talk about Apple and the App Store rules without acknowledging that there are whole classes of apps that never come to exist because of Apple's rules. And it's not just the ones that Apple refuses to let exist or decides retroactively after many, many app approvals that now it's not going to exist, like iDOS, which is a whole other thing, right? Which is like, this developer has worked really well with App Review and it's done, you know, and it's running obviously in the sandbox in emulation and it's using the file access for various things, but it got approvals and all of that. But it's also every other developer who has an idea and looks at the rules and goes, oh, they'll probably reject it, so I'm not going to waste my time working on it. And the platform suffers. The platform withers because on Mac, you can just make it. And if Apple doesn't like it, too bad, right? But on iPad, you can't even think about making it. Because if you think about making it, you'll realize you got to stop thinking and move on to something else, because the risk of Apple rejecting you initially or years later, just sweeping in and saying, oh, we decided we don't want you in the store. And so we lose. Like, I love that Harry McCracken is playing TRS-80 games and running TRS-80 apps on his iPad. He, you know, it is so cool. And this is Apple saying, no, we'll have no fun here, we'll have no nonsense here. But there's a real cost. The real cost is whole classes of apps, clever apps, brilliant apps, apps that might even change the world, right? That will never come to be because the developer will be like, well, I'll just build a different iPad app. I'll build a different iPhone app because I don't want to risk Apple rejecting me.
Right. Or the, you know, the flip side of apps that it doesn't want to allow, that it will just, like, you know, not come to the platform or come to the platform in a lesser way. Yeah. I'm thinking of the, like, Microsoft game streaming app.
Sure.
Right. Or it's like, all right, well, I guess we'll make a web app. And it's like, you know what? They did pretty well for what a web app is capable of. I've used it. It's pretty good. But you sit there going... If people really want that, they're going to buy something else because they don't want to deal with the fact that it's a substandard solution.
Yeah, that's literally just Apple doesn't want this
competition. That's totally
on the
competition.
There is, so another thing that's going to come up, it started this week and it is going to be out there, is Netflix this week announced that it is going into games. And the idea is literally Netflix wants to develop games and put them in the Netflix app, mobile games.
Yeah.
And it will be part of your, it'll be in the Netflix app, and I guess it'll be part of your Netflix subscription. And so there's a question whether on iOS, whether they'll claim to be kind of like Roblox or something, where they're essentially like nobody's buying anything. But there'll still be like individual games, and is Apple going to say each of them needs to be submitted to the store separately? Yeah, so, and it's like Netflix Arcade, basically, and it's the same idea. I mean, it's a dumb idea, and I think Netflix shouldn't waste their time with it. But at the same time, here we go. Here's another one.
But this technology is not going away.
No,
it's going to be bigger and bigger because it has serious advantages. And if Apple's saying we're not going to let any of those play on our platform, mainly because we're worried that it'll take away from Apple Arcade or the other games that we sell on our platform, then that is shooting itself in the foot because, A, it's just petty. B, it's possibly illegal. And C, I think there's this whole, like, Apple Arcade, say of it what you will. I think some people like it a lot. Some people have been less than wowed by it. But I feel like, you know what? Compete on how good your games are, right? Like, if you're really convinced that your game platform is better, you know, it should stand up against all those things and you should feel confident about it. If your answer is, well, our game platform won't succeed unless there's literally no other options, then maybe your game platform isn't very good.
Yeah. Yep. That's it. I mean, I think that where Apple comes down... And again, there are arguments that Apple makes and that Apple's defenders will make about why Apple's actually doing this. But the truth is, if it's perceived as being primarily about limiting competition and that the rest of it is a smokescreen, that is the most damaging to Apple of anything, right? And that's what's going to spur movement and spur changes forced upon Apple, is this perception that Apple is not doing this because... it wants to protect the users. It's doing it because it wants to protect itself. And in doing so, harm its platform, which is the part that really drives me crazy, because it's sort of like what it really wants to do is protect its money, even if it hurts the platform and makes it less rich. So I do wonder, though, you know, like Apple makes this big thing about, like, oh, well, if they submitted the apps individually to the App Store in Xbox Arcade, we would let that happen. And I think to myself, well, great. Maybe what you guys should be working on is a way to somehow bless content that's running inside other apps in a method that is not going to require the current method of uploading binaries to the store, if that makes any sense. Like, if this is the future, you know, you could, if you're Apple, say, we're working with Microsoft to find a new path forward for apps like this. But instead, they have no motivation to do it other than the fear of being regulated, which, you know, I think it's interesting to see their moves and see that I'm not sure the fear has reached everyone who's involved yet.
Well, here's the thing with the game stuff. I just don't even think, I think all that is just, I don't know, it's so much nonsense. Because all games are, first of all, it's not like Microsoft isn't approving games that go into its cloud gaming service, right? You can't just upload a game willy-nilly to that. You have to work with them. Therefore, it's already being run through some sort of approval process. It's already being run through a ratings process because games are rated much like content that you watch in a streaming app, right? Like, there are game ratings in the same way that there are MPAA ratings or TV ratings or what have you. So it's not as though that content can't be described and filtered. If the answer was just, well, Microsoft's game service thing has to work with our, you know, screen time parental controls or whatever, it's like, oh, well, that's fine. Yeah. I can understand why you want to do that.
That's sort of what I'm saying. I wonder if there's another approach. If Apple was legitimately concerned about this, there's probably another approach they could take, which is, again, like having Microsoft maintain a bunch of metadata about this and have that, you know, appear in the App Store or in some other way. And do like there, Apple could say, here's a way that this sort of thing could be a good member of this platform. But what Apple said is, no, follow our rules that were invented more than a decade ago. That's what you need to do. And you know, again, when you consider Apple's reasoning for it, I don't know. I mean, again, Apple doesn't have a lot of credibility. That's the truth of it is. Apple making rejections of things in its store, whether they're big players like Microsoft or little players like iDOS, Apple has not a shred of credibility left. Like, everybody believes that Apple is making decisions for its own benefit and not its users' benefit in order to protect. It's got a reputation now as a company that is just trying to be as greedy as possible, take as much money off the table as possible, and limit as much competition as possible. And again, is that actually true? It's like, no, it's much more complicated than that. But perception is reality when it comes to how you're being assaulted in the halls of Congress and at the European Union and at various court cases, right? Mm-hmm. So... yeah. I don't know. It's just, again, though, I just come back to the tragedy of it all, which is, and I think you really covered it well, which is who was being hurt by an app like this? Yeah. And what was it not great for the people who cared about it and great for the platform that it exists? And shouldn't there be more? Shouldn't there be legitimate virtualization? Yeah. And like, why is the story of this platform that stuff keeps getting kicked off and limiting the platform? Why does it feel like Apple's its own worst enemy?
Especially when as we've talked about in the past with the integration of the M1 chip or in the latest iPad Pros.
Yeah.
The difference has become even more apparent, right? Because you're saying this really is just arbitrary. It really is just we don't want to allow this thing.
Yeah.
And that's frustrating. I mean, why are people going to pick this over a Mac if they feel like, I don't know, I can't use the stuff I want. I don't have as many options.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think it's unsustainable in the long run because sooner or later you have things like virtualization that are genuinely useful for people doing work, right? Virtualization is an extremely useful technology and there are a lot of legitimate uses for it. And if you're going to say those will never run on our platform, you have just cut off a huge number of use cases.
And I'm not entirely clear. I mean, this may be a mistaken rejection kind of thing, but I don't understand why the two command line apps are allowed in the store then, right? Because they can execute code.
At best, Apple needs to redo that rule about you can't have executable code because there are so many things that are like, well, except for this, right? Like, except for Roblox or whatever, except for these shell apps. It's like, just redo that, right? Like, find another way to phrase that, narrow the scope a little bit. If there are things you are legitimately concerned about as security problems, fine. But you can fine-tune that to the point where it's not just a blanket regulation that's being thrown over an entire class of apps and putting them all under the same heading of, these are things we don't allow because they're bad for the platform, because it's simply not true.
One other thing that I wrote about this week over at Macworld was I did another Safari 15 piece because last week the new beta versions came out and I've been thinking about sort of what Apple's doing here, and the piece is a real mixed bag because I have two feelings about this. Like,
just two?
I categorize them in two categories. So there's what Apple's doing about it, which is that clearly, Apple realizes that this is not great. Like that, which is a good sign, right? For people who are worried, like, oh, Apple's not going to listen to the criticism; it's just going to power on. Like, that's not true. Like, we can already see Apple is scrambling in their betas, and I've had people from Apple say to me, like, this is a beta cycle and we are taking feedback and we are making changes, right? Like, Apple is basically committed to the idea that they are going to listen to what people have to say about the problems with Safari 15 and address it in betas. And in fact, the Mac beta, having spent a little more time with it, because I used that beta most of this week while I was working, it's funny because it's an attempt. It's literally like somebody checked in sort of like step one of 5 steps to fix the problems, and they shipped it because it's bad. I think it's bad. I think it's arguably worse than the previous beta, but it's trying to go in a direction that's good, but it's not. It only took 1 step on that journey. Like the fact that you can't even tell what tab is active anymore, it's so hard.
Yeah.
Legibility got worse, but I think in the service I'm getting better. So on all that, I feel like it's good news, because even though we still may not be in a good place with these betas, I think Apple has sent the message loud and clear that it has heard the criticism of Safari 15 and it is trying to figure out a way to do it better and essentially undo some of the things it was trying. So this is going to be a summer where there's a lot, you know, we've got another like month and a half, at least 2 months, where I think the betas are going to change in Safari beta by beta. It's going to be different. So that's bucket one. And then there's bucket two. Bucket two of my feelings is, why did this happen? It's who thought that this was good, so good that they would put it in their presentation for WWDC. Who thought that they could ship this thing and that it worked fine? Who was that? And why is it that whoever that was at Apple got presumably to overrule, I would imagine, lots of people at Apple who are very smart about user interface, who saw this and thought, wow, this is bad? Or alternate potential path, people who never saw it because they hid this away to be a big reveal, and the people who could have stopped it never saw it. I don't know what the truth is there, but that's it. What I came to in my story on Macworld, and it's in the headline as it turns out, is let's not forget that although Apple is trying to make this right, this is a self-inflicted wound. It didn't need to do this. It didn't need to do it. Why did it do it? And you know, saying, oh, well, you know, they want to be provocative and all that. Yeah, but that beta was, you know, when they make announcements at WWDC, it's like a fait accompli, right? They're like, we have reinvented Safari, and here it is, and isn't it great? And it was not great. And yet somebody believes their own PR. Let's put it that way. Somebody believes their own PR and that this thing is great. And it's not. It's not. And I know some people like it. I think the problem is not Apple's ambition. I think the problem is Apple's execution, and that they've, as we've said and everybody else has said, they made some trade-offs to do a thing that I think is probably admirable, but they've cost too much in legibility and usability. But like I that's the part that really stops me, is like, it's great that we're on this path where they're going to undo the damage, but they did the damage to themselves. Why did that happen?
Right. Yeah. I think there's a lot of questions about it, and I don't quite understand the logic. I understand the rationale. I think it's, like you said, the execution is bad, and it reeks in some places of a kind of an Apple hubris, which is certainly a quality that Apple is afflicted with, right? Mm-hmm. Which is, everything should change around us, basically, because what we're doing is great.
Right.
And the rest of you, what you're doing, it's not so good. You can make it better. And yeah. It's like, well, so that's a little...
He didn't put it on Daring Fireball, but Gruber had a tweet this week that was basically like the arrogance of this move to say the web will change for us.
Right. And the more to the point, we already made you all change your sites to adapt to a mobile... version of a web browser, and now we're telling you that you have to change it again. And frankly, I do think, because I've run into the same problem. I think Federico had a tweet about this too, where he was like trying to order food. I was like, I've run into the exact same thing. I was filling out something. You can't hit the button.
So
you can kind of do it, but it's bad that you have to work.
I understand why. So one of the recurring motifs in iOS 15 and iPadOS 15 is that they are trying to move away from like bars to floating items. They think that floating items are cool, like little and that address bar on the iPhone is one example of that. But on the iPad, you see this all over the place, where there's stuff that used to be like in a big bar at the bottom of the screen, where instead it's in a little floating bar. And the advantages are, if there's not a lot in the bar, it's very small, and it's floating right there on the screen with a little curved edges and all that, and it's cute. The disadvantage is it's floating above content or user interface, and apps are going to need to take advantage of, like, move out of the way of it. And web pages, So they bring it to Safari, and now they're saying web pages need to move out of the way of it. And like, again, right. I understand the motivation there, which is having a big bar that spans your the whole screen is a lot. It's very heavy, and if you only have three items, that bar is across, you know, it could fit 20 items, but you only have three, it's a waste of space. I get it. Right. I get all of that. The problem is they extend it to Safari, and now they're saying everybody has to redesign their web pages to get out of this thing. I mean, and again, and Apple's attitude at WWDC was you need to update your pages. Like literally, Worldwide Developer Conference is now a conference for every web designer in the world because Apple's going to make them do custom things to get rid of their, you know, their UI that's hidden under Apple's UI. And it's just, it's
That's not a great look. Yeah, no. I think
and not necessary because you especially could, on the iPhone, it probably should just be a toolbar. Yes.
Yeah, exactly. It should be a thing at the bottom. You can still make it collapse when you scroll, right? Like it does
like
now.
It does
now. Totally fine.
No, the reason it's not a toolbar is because they have this, the designers have this kind of this motif of like, oh, well, but it's like all the other things that we're doing. We don't want to change our design system for this one thing. And the answer needs to be perhaps you need to modify your design system because sometimes you don't want to float over content. Maybe.
Yeah. 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 I agree. I think I would be surprised. I've come around to thinking now, you know, I know we disputed this earlier in the beta process of how much they would change it. And I've come around to thinking that I don't think they can ship it the way it is now on iPhone because I think it's gotten enough attention and it's frustrating enough that I can only imagine, as I'm sure you can, dealing with the repeated like discussions with non-technically savvy people who update to iOS 15 this fall and are just like,
nobody,
what is this?
Nobody update your iPhone because then you can't order DoorDash, somebody will say, or whatever.
Yep. And I'm just picturing talking to my wife, explaining to my wife, and she's going to be like, this is terrible. Why would anybody do this? I'm like,
I understand Apple's impulse and how they want to move. They never want to rest on their laurels, and they want to think, is there a way to do this better?
But the problem is isn't better.
That ultimately, I think this isn't better. And they know that now, right? They know that. The problem is, should they have known that from the beginning? And I suspect a lot of people did know that. And this is why I'm fascinated by that side of it, because clearly there's something dysfunctional inside of Apple. Because I don't mean that Apple doing this itself is fundamentally suggesting that Apple is broken. But I am saying that this seemed like a pretty obvious one where there should have been a lot more internal discussion about all the issues involved. And that they're probably somebody should have had to make some concessions and realize that the most extreme example of this wasn't practical. And that, I mean, honestly, this is Apple. That all should have happened completely behind the scenes in secret. So that what they stepped on their virtual stage in June to talk about was something that everybody at Apple could get behind and say, we've tested this and it's rock solid. And I know it's different, but you're going to like it. And instead, somehow, that didn't happen, and it became readily apparent that this stuff was going to be rejected by everybody. I mean, rejected by a lot of people for good reasons, I would say. And like, why did you do that to yourself? What concerns me is it means that there are some people at Apple who are able to shut off the feedback of other people at Apple who in this case were probably exactly right. And that's troubling, right? Because that means you've got somebody in a position of power who does not want to listen to the other people at Apple who want to make their products good.
Right. Yeah. And
not good.
Always a question of where in the hierarchy is that person positioned, right? It's like Steve Jobs used to do that.
Sure.
But
he had
a good instinct for it for the most part.
Right. And again, they would back off it. This does happen. And who knows? This may be a unique set of circumstances in a lot of ways. I know a lot of people like to mention names, but I feel like we don't really know who the people are who are involved in this stuff. So, you know, Marco on ATP always likes to talk about Alan Dye. Well, you know, just like Johnny Ive before him, the figurehead of the design group is a great person to target. But like, we don't know. We don't know who championed this. We don't know who came up with it. We don't know what the internal divisions are. It's entirely possible that there were people in the design group who didn't like it, but they were cowed by people in the design group who were more into it. Tim Cook loves it. Because again, it's a thing that looks good, but then doesn't work in practice when you use it. And that's the, so the people who sign off at a top level, are they just looking, have they been sold a bill of goods? Again, we just don't know what's going on inside the black box, but it is a little bit of a troubling sign. However, the, on the upside, the whatever power was there to say, we're going to go out with this, and this is what we're going to do at WWDC, seemed to crumble immediately. I mean, Dan, I without getting to the details, because again, I'm not supposed to talk about like Apple briefings in detail, but I will just say that in my conversations with people who were authorized representatives of Apple the week of WWDC, I already sensed a lack of forceful support of Safari's features. Let me put it that way, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Like, mm-hmm. it already, as somebody who's been in these briefings a lot over the years, I already felt like they're like, oh, we're taking feedback. You know, it's good to hear about that. We know that this is a big step. And like, Apple doesn't say that when they're completely all in on a feature, right? They'll be like, no, it's great.
Sure.
It's great because of these reasons. And people are going to like it when they use it. And they already weren't doing that. So, you know. I think whoever championed this feature, like, there were lots of people at Apple like, this isn't going to work. This isn't going to make it. Let's just, you know. So there it is. So the system works, I guess, this time, I guess.
Well, we'll see. We'll see. We got a few more betas before we...
You know, I'm cognizant of the fact that Gruber linked to that guy who's like, it's great. And most people think it's great, which is like, no, that's not true. But I'm cognizant of the fact that
there's opinions. People can have opinions about this stuff.
And then most importantly, as somebody who's gone through redesigns of magazines and websites and stuff over the years, yeah, people don't like change. What you don't want to see is a process of trying new things beaten down and destroyed because people don't want new things. Because sometimes it is Apple's job to shake things up and make us uncomfortable. And sometimes then we get comfortable and we're like, oh, this was a better idea. The problem is sometimes they try that and they fail, and sometimes they try that and they succeed. So the right thing to do is not to support everything they do, nor beat down on everything that they do, but instead try to form some sort of opinion about, does this particular thing work? So I hope that what comes out of this is a recognition that this time they didn't make it, and they got to work on it, and not sort of a, oh, geez, we can never touch one of our apps again. There's several apps that I would like Apple to redesign. Safari wasn't one of them, but here we are.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I guess we'll see what happens. The beta process is ongoing.
Every beta is going to be interesting now. Oh, man.
There's going to be a lot more scrutiny, I feel like, than there is on previous ones, where it was like, you know, oh, well, there's some refinements. There's some couple new features. Things have been turned on, et cetera. And now it's like, okay, will they fix Safari in this one?
I guess we'll see. Maybe. All right. We will be back next week. For more, thank you for being a subscriber. Until next time. Bye, Dan.
Bye, Jason.